Hey everyone, we're grateful for your support and hope our podcast has been helpful in both your personal and professional journey. We've added new continuing education webinars to our website. And as you renew your license, head over and check out our available courses. We'll be adding even more in the future, so stay tuned. And now, without further ado, let's dive into today's episode. So how can psychoanalysis be more inclusive, especially for therapists and communities of color? How might we incorporate the scholarly writings by people of color as part of the psychodynamic training curriculum? And how might that look like to engage in an anti-racist and decolonial psychodynamic framework? The possibilities are endless when we are willing to dismantle, divest, and support each other in the rebuilding process. Welcome to People of Color in Psychology, the show that explores mental health topics specific to culture, diversity, and communities of color. I am your host, Jack Tsen. Our guest today is Dr. Mei Yang Kadaba, a licensed psychologist in private practice, an adjunct faculty at the Wright Institute, and founder of Coloring Psychoanalysis. Additionally, Dr. Kadaba was the past chair of the Division of Practice in the Asian American Psychological Association, was recognized by the American Psychological Association's Minority Fellowship Program, and she has been on several podcasts. Deeply rooted in her bilingual, bicultural upbringing between China and the United States, Dr. Kadaba dedicates her work to uplifting the perspectives of fellow travelers between worlds. She's profoundly grateful for the inspiration and strength offered by her BIPOC elders and peers in anti-oppressive psychoanalysis, AAPI psychology, and other liberational and decolonial pursuits. As a Chinese-American psychologist, Dr. Kadaba will be discussing ways to pull away from psychodynamics' oppressive roots and talk about the amazing project of coloring psychoanalysis. Dr. Kadaba, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jack. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. We've had some folks talk about psychodynamic therapies and the environment, and I'm curious for you, which is, in what way is psychodynamic oppressive?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's a big question.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you know, that from my perspective, it's a complex question because I feel like I can't completely answer that question without also addressing what feels liberatory about it. So maybe there's a way that I can weave in and out between those two polarities or possibilities. Because when I talk about psychoanalysis with folks, particularly people who are coming into the field, who are BIPOC or just other BIPOC practitioners in the field who maybe aren't as familiar or felt actually pushed away, I think sometimes I get this question of why psychoanalysis a lot. Because it is very traditional. It's you know, the very beginnings of our field come from psychoanalysis and Freud and Klein, et cetera. So it has a particular reputation. It has I think in modern times, there's a perception about what it is. But I think for me, as a person of color, as an immigrant, as you mentioned in the intro, I myself identify as 1.5 generation. I moved here a couple of times, actually. I lived in three different countries when I was a child and moved back and forth quite a bit, including China, US, and very briefly in Japan. And the reason why I bring that up, wanting to bring it up in a kind of linkage to psychoanalysis, is with this kind of multicultural, multilingual upbringing that I had, and the particular, I think, exposure to different perspectives, different ways of looking at the world, different ways of understanding relationships and how the self is formed, I think, in relation to others. I really found that when I came into psychology, I really felt like there was nowhere else in our field that really was able to encapsulate the astonishing, you know, both diversity and also depth of what it means to be human, you know, what it means to have a human experience, to be related to each other, to be related to ourselves, our minds, our spirits in a way. And so that's why I feel like it's hard to talk about what feels oppressive about psychoanalysis without first, I think, sharing a little bit about what I find captivating and also such a beautiful potential, I think, in these theories and ideas.
So when you're talking about these theories and ideas, right, you're talking about this relationship with the world around us and really connecting with that, but also object relations or psychodynamic is about objects, about different relationships.
Yes.
And so are you, because the way you're describing it, it does feel it has that potential. Psychodynamic has that potential from a more liberation approach. And so is that what you're getting at? Like, let's talk about the liberation side of it before we get into the oppressive
Absolutely.
Side.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. I think that line is to me very clear, you know, and I feel like within psychoanalysis, there's, you know, even though these theories may not have been developed with that explicit focus on anti-oppression, liberation, but I think here we have a rich body of language and ideas because it's so focused on human relationship, on really delineating how the mind works, how our unconscious gets formed and how it interacts with other people, with our environment, with the world. To me, I always felt like there was this through line from even the very early days of Freud and, you know, Anna Freud and Klein, Winnicott, et cetera, all the way through exactly these very modern contemporary theories. You know, nowadays we talk so much about attachment, but to me, that's kind of how we have modern language for ideas around object relations that have been in evolution for, you know, 100, 150 years plus. So I just feel like there's so much richness and application of psychoanalysis, specifically in, I think, a lot of what we as BIPOC people and mental health providers are pursuing today, you know, in terms of our work, in terms of the work that we do with our clients, that it just made so much sense. It made so much sense to look at it this way, again, for me. So with that background, I think that now then I can sort of talk a little bit more about what does the oppression look like that I've understood as I've been, you know, in this part of our field. And I think it's twofold, at least. On the one hand, I was earlier referring to, you know, this reputation of psychoanalysis as being very white, very male. And I think these problems, very, very straight, heteronormative, et cetera. And I think these are real problems that are rooted in the theories themselves. I think that's really undeniable. The theories itself. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think if we think about one example that comes to mind is the pathologizing of homosexuality. You know, that's been codified, that had been codified in the DSM until I want to say it was the 70s or so, that had real roots in psychoanalytic thinking. That psychoanalysis, unfortunately, because of the way that ideas around defenses and, you know, pathological ways of relating or ways of maladaptiveness to the environment, that it's really easy to adopt this kind of language and to adopt a kind of positionality of the provider as the expert, as the knowledge holder, to then be able to, you know, say, oh, you are problematic. You don't fit within this, you know, universal, typical model of whatever, without really examining, well, why is that the assumption? You know, who's the person who's labeling what is normal and typical, et cetera. So that's a really, I think, glaring example, but I think it pervades so much of, you know, what is assumed in what gets written about. And I think psychoanalysis, it has certain strengths that really are double-edged swords, in that it's a way of practice that's very depth-oriented and based on scholarship, I think, you know, based on writing and this kind of exchange of ideas, like in this really old school way, you know, of, I imagine, correspondences that people are, you know, writing papers back and forth and dialoguing with each other and debating these theories. Like that, I feel like that's a tradition that's still very much alive in psychoanalysis, that's different from, I think, other more contemporary, you know, theories or behavioral based theories that are much more like practice based. So I think, I mean, personally, I find that there's a poetry in that, there's a thoughtfulness, there's an artistry, I think, in this way of thinking about the human condition that I find really beautiful. And again, is part of that, you know, I think liberatory potential. But at the same time, I think that's also where a lot of these problems will arise. It's sort of like, well, who's doing the thinking? Who's doing the talking? Who's doing the examining? And then once things get codified, once things sort of take on that position of power, then we start, those assumptions go underground almost. We don't see.
Well, who's also included in these debates? Who's included in the writings, the conversations?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because if, yeah, let's say we have a BIPOC clinician or BIPOC psychodynamic theorist writing, mm-hmm, nobody writes back. There's no dialogue. There's no interchange.
Yeah.
There's no exchange in the ideas.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's... And I think that links into the second way that I think oppression gets built in, enacted into psychoanalytic spaces, you know, that not only are the theories really full of biases in terms of, again, who is the typical and also who's the therapist versus who's the patient, but that then leads into, and when I say spaces, I mean, like literally gatherings of people, you know, whether it traditionally around institutions. And again, there's this very old school, like scholarly way that psychoanalysis is still practiced today, that they're organized very much around training institutions, that these are places where these theories get debated, they get written and created. But my experience within these spaces is that one, BIPOC people are not as present. I don't know if, you know, compare sort of numerically, statistically speaking, if there are more or less BIPOC identified professionals in psychoanalysis compared to other spaces, but it's certainly a minority. When I just think about, you know, conferences that I go to or events and lectures I attend, I have to say I've gotten into the habit of, one, checking out who is speaking beforehand and really being cautious if there isn't someone on the panels that, you know, either identifies as BIPOC or I read their bio and there isn't something that's explicitly spoken about, you know, having an anti-oppressive, anti-decolonial kind of orientation, I get real nervous about it if that's not present. And then the other practice I've gotten into is trying to make sure that I'm there with people that I know and trust who tend to be BIPOC as well. And I think these are practices that came from earlier experiences that I had, you know, in training earlier on in my career, where the standards of whiteness, of what are the ideas that are talked about. Again, because psychoanalysis is such a theory based, that the practice really comes from ideas a lot of the time, you know, but of course, nowadays, I think that's in practice, of course, there's a lot of, I think, relational dynamics that are happening, but at its core, you know, these ideas of transference, counter-transference, projection, introjection, I mean, this is sort of the bread and butter of, I think, how psychodynamic, psychoanalytic therapy is understood. So in the room, as, you know, as we get into discussions, as theories get brought up and ideas and cases are discussed, it's very quick that I start to feel alone, minoritized, both in sort of the ideas that are being talked about and also the way that the conversation is had, that there's, you know, there's a lot of like unemotional language that gets used, very academic, that we don't, you know, that we don't bring in our feelings, things don't feel embodied. And so it's really visceral for me in the room a lot of the time. And so knowing that I have allies, knowing that it's a conversation that's going to be more permissive of or inviting of kind of different ways or alternative ways of being and talking. I've just kind of learned over the years that that's something that I really need to pay attention to and be very kind of mindful and careful about the psychoanalytic spaces that I step into.
Yeah. I'm just having this image of you in a group, like a circle, a bunch of majority white folks that, you know, and of course, conversations are very academic. But I guess I'm also thinking the theory itself is about emotions. And I mean, it brings emotions. So why are we not working with it in the room?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, gosh, sounds horrible. Just being in that kind of space.
It's really, you know, and I think you're really hitting the nail on the head of this conundrum that I grapple with all the time, because in my clinical practice, my private practice is predominantly Asian American. And I, you know, in the consultation space, I mean, you're absolutely right. What I'm trying to say is just that you're totally right, that the practice of these theories, for me anyway, feels very embodied. You know, we use our bodies, we talk about, you know, physical sensations, emotion, absolutely, and as well as ideas. So I think this is the conundrum that I feel within being a psychodynamic practitioner is, again, you know, the reality and my way of practicing with my clients and what I see as its potential and how I myself have benefited is just miles and miles away from what's happening in terms of the theory, in terms of knowledge production, or what sort of, you know, and what gets seen as valuable or worthwhile within the field. And so I think that's really the crux of, I think, a lot of what I've grappled with since coming into, I think, this part of the field.
That's the ongoing thing you're wrestling with. And it's just interesting that I've been having a lot more folks on the podcast who are practicing psychodynamic therapy. I actually used to enjoy doing it, you know, or studying it. That was my early training. But over the years, just practical reasons, working in large healthcare systems, it's very difficult to apply those concepts. But, you know, now that many of us are doing private practice, we do have a better opportunity to lean into this. Or once you finish that initial layer of CBT treatment, then you can start digging into some of the depth work.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Can I add a couple points? Because what you're saying here is making me think of yet another layer to all of this. Both we're talking about, you know, liberation versus oppression within psychoanalysis or the practice of it. That I think on a structural level, I think there's also that spectrum where psychoanalysis is concerned. That on the one hand, to me, having chosen to come out of graduate school and licensing and going into private practice was a very deliberate choice for me because of, I think, how radical these days it is for people, particularly people of color, to seek out more open-ended, depth-oriented psychotherapy as opposed to, you know, getting an 8-week treatment or, you know, only maybe being limited in terms of resources, of only being able to go into, you know, systems or institutions that are more CBT oriented or time limited, which is not to say that they're not effective or beneficial, absolutely. But there's almost something like really radical these days, you know, about clients being able to have that amount of space to engage with themselves and for therapists to be able to work in this way. So to me, there's something really meaningful as a psychologist of color working with clients of color to be, you know, practicing psychotherapy using these theories in this particular kind of structure that's very open-ended, that doesn't have, you know, it feels in and of itself pushing back against limitations, against, you know, structures that we are so used to having to deal with. But on the oppressive end of it, you know, speaking of kind of how structurally psychoanalysis enacts these oppressive processes, I guess, going back to the idea that a lot of, you know, what's cutting edge in psychoanalysis is still happening within these institutions and organizations, that removal of emotion, I think, has a lot to do with how I've seen racism really being perpetuated. That when we don't talk about emotions, when we don't allow people to have reactions, we don't legitimize that. And in fact, we weaponize the theory to pathologize. I'll give you an example. I was applying for a one-year training program, because I was really hesitant to kind of jump into anything that was more involved. You know, psychoanalytic training, of course, takes years, a heavy investment, which is in and of itself an oppressive factor prohibitive factor for most people. So I figured, you know, here was a one-year program that specifically had a sociopolitical focus. You know, that's what they wanted to do. They were, you know, actively seeking applicants who wanted to learn and explore that way. So I was like, this is sort of as perfect as it can get. And I, you know, got all the way through to an interview with the director of the program, who was a white woman. And I just decided that I was going to go for it, to be really upfront and honest, that here I am as an applicant of color, who's really interested and excited about this program, but have also been around enough to know what happens to applicants of color, to people of color within these institutions, that we get marginalized, we get pathologized, and we get very silenced. And so I just asked her point blank about, you know, what does she think about that? And are there support structures? Are there intentional supports and thought being put into place, not just sort of acknowledging, oh, this is something that happens, but how are we going to sort of systemically deal with this problem that inevitably comes up in psychoanalytic training spaces? And the response I got was that I was overly anxious, that I was maybe unwilling to kind of enter the process of, you know, as an individual, into sort of just the messy group dynamics that come up when, you know, in the course of learning and discussing psychoanalysis.
That sounds so dismissive.
And it told me everything that I needed to know. So, but, you know, and that's a personal story, but I think not an uncommon one. I mean, in big and small ways, this happens. And what I mean, the point that I'm trying to make is that so much of this is baked into the structures that uphold and advance psychoanalysis today. It can get labeled as anxious, or, you know, projecting, or whatever it is.
Yeah. You didn't take the training, did you? You didn't sign up for it?
I did not. I did not. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
But I think, I mean, maybe this is a good point to kind of pivot into talking about coloring psychoanalysis, because for me, what I'm trying to create, and what we already have, I think, created, is, I think, a reimagining of the antithesis of what's out there. And really my kind of very passionate beliefs of what psychoanalysis can and should be for people of color. That, you know, what I described to you, this training program, was, I think, really one of the last attempts that I made to find a place within existing psychoanalytic structures. I mean, ever since then, I've really stepped away, other than, you know, attending, like I said, very carefully chosen sort of lectures and talks, but I've become very protective of my time and energy and labor. It's my own kind of divestment, honestly, to no longer put my resources into upholding and building these spaces can be so harmful to people like me. So that was a very conscious decision that I made to turn away. And I do use the word divest. And instead, I think launched the website for Coloring Psychoanalysis just about a year ago. And so far there's been over 230 people who have signed up from across the country and internationally, actually from folks of different backgrounds, you know, various ethnic cultural backgrounds, students, teachers, practitioners, all different levels of, you know, licensure, different types of licensure. So I think it's, you know, it started out as a sort of this vision that I was cultivating within myself of if I could have the psychoanalysis that I want for me and people like me and my clients, what would it look like? But I think since then, it's something that clearly resonates with many people who've had similar experiences and frustrations and hopes. So I'll just say a little bit of what Coloring Psychoanalysis is. It's an online space, it's a digital space for people who dream of liberatory psychoanalysis made for and by us that really puts at the center our experiences, feelings and reactions, our ways of looking at the world, our languages, that this is a space where I think we can recover and really reclaim our own wholeness, our psychic and sort of spiritual wholeness, using ideas within psychoanalysis, but also influencing it, pushing it into, I think, new territories.
So as you're describing this, it sounds like it's taking some of that interaction and dialogue of advancing theory and practice mm-hmm. from the old model mm-hmm. and essentially making it more inclusive and to converse in a way that resonates for people of color. And I'm wondering, you know, because this is something I want to sign up for, your newsletter, right? Coloring Psychoanalysis, I think mm-hmm. you sign up for a newsletter. Do you have to be like someone who's involved in this community, who's interested in learning about psychodynamic work? Do I have to, you know, I did a 1-year internship, you know, based on psychodynamics, and that was it. But I think more needs to happen. So I'm trying mm-hmm. to get an idea of like how advanced do I need to be for our listeners, right? You know, to sign mm-hmm. up and be involved in this community.
You can be advanced. You can just be someone who's curious, who is like, what is psychoanalysis? You don't even have to be a practitioner. In fact, I think one of a part of this dream is also not only to make psychoanalysis more inclusive and reflective, but to democratize it as well. That I think at the heart of it, psychoanalysis or psychoanalytic ideas, it didn't, even though I know Freud himself really pushed the beginnings of the theory and this psychology, really, I mean, that's what psychology was back then. He really very intentionally pushed it into, you know, more of a medical sphere and very academic. And I think he did that very intentionally to create more clout and establish it as a kind of science. But I think from the very beginning, there was always interaction. I mean, if we think even about, you know, the Oedipal complex as one of these sort of core, like founding myths of psychoanalytic theory, it draws from a Greek story and myth, which if we think about it, exists across different cultures and different histories. I mean, all of our own ancestors have creation myths or, you know, heroes and epics. And, you know, from the very early theorists, there were always these crossovers with other fields like art and literature, poetry, music, you know, that if it's about the human experience, I think it can be present in psychoanalysis. It can inform it. So I would love for, you know, not only folks who are interested in psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, to come and be a part of this collective and read and discuss, but, you know, linguists, artists, musicians, you know, just anybody who's sort of interested in what it means to be human, what it means to be a BIPOC person, living more fully, living more joyously, to be a part of the conversation.
What beautiful work that you've created.
This is the hope. This is the dream. Yeah. We're taking first steps.
I like it. And your first release article is March?
Yes, yes. So our first issue is scheduled to launch on March 22nd. And we also have, we're going to be having a launch celebration that will have music and storytelling and a reading, among other things, and also hopefully just interactive activities, you know, where people can come and feel like they're a part of what's being formed.
Wow. And this is all done virtually online?
This is all virtual, yes.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Okay. And I guess I'll be able to put the material you have on our show notes for this episode.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Come to the website and it'll have everything that you need. The key thing I would recommend is to sign up, because one of the things that I'm trying to do that I'm being very intentional about is that this is a space by and really for BIPOC people. And so a lot of this information isn't distributed publicly. I mean, obviously the website is, but please sign up in order to receive things like registration links, access to the issue, which is going to be password protected, because we really want to, as much as possible, you know, and nowadays in online spaces, of course, nothing's 100%, but to really feel like we're sitting in a room together that is for us, for people who self-identify as BIPOC.
Ooh, I'm excited. Oh gosh, I hope I can make it and get, you know, free up my schedule and join this launch day.
I hope so. That would be a lot of fun, I think.
But yeah, let's include that in the show notes so people can sign up. So
yeah.
Dr. Kadaba, you've already shared with us some of the challenges that you've experienced in throughout your journey and learning and training in psychodynamic theories. Can you share with me what were challenges that you faced and overcame that you would be willing to share?
I'm so glad you're asking that explicitly, because I know when I talk about this, sometimes I'm by nature, I think, a very optimistic person. And I think a lot of that is also informed by being an immigrant and being an Asian woman, where I have learned and I think been sort of culturally conditioned to downplay things that, you know, experiences that have been difficult or challenges. And so I'm really glad that you're asking this, because it gives me a chance to respond more explicitly, because there's been a lot. And I think the biggest thing that comes to mind, and again, I'm hoping that coloring psychoanalysis can help address for myself and for others, is not having community or having to do so much extra legwork to find people that share similar goals and values and, you know, experiences, identities, et cetera, who are also interested in psychoanalysis. I think your question just brought me right all the way back to being an early graduate student. I came into psychology from medicine, actually. I was pre-med all the way through undergrad, you know, followed that path for a while until it wasn't right for me anymore. And I made a pivot into psychology, having really not a whole lot of experience with mental health and psychology. I think my background and family is really kind of a typical Asian immigrant story where, you know, that's just not something that we knew about. There was stigma around it. And I had never really pursued any of it for myself. And so when I first got introduced to mental health and psychology, I just fell in love with Yalom's writings, the more humanistic, you know, way of and relational way of looking at psychotherapy. So I just kind of was hooked and from there found myself into psychoanalysis. But that meant that right away off the bat, I started to see that, I don't think there are a lot of people like me. The teachers who were teaching psychoanalysis were not like me, but not addressing any of these questions. You know, I don't want to erase folks of color, immigrants who already are here in psychoanalysis, but I feel like we're all limited by the theories, the writings, the ways and structures that teaching and training happens in psychoanalysis. that we're all bound, you know, so in my early days, very quickly, I saw that I wasn't meeting the mentors that I had hoped for, the peers that I hoped for. I started, I think, just gathering, like every class, I would have these questions in my mind of, but what about, you know, we'd be learning a theory. And then, of course, my mind would very naturally go to, you know, clients of color that I was seeing, or myself, or my family members, you know, because I'd start to kind of see them reflected in it. And I would get really excited. But then at a certain point, something would switch. And I would be like, something doesn't make sense anymore, or I have more questions, and something doesn't quite fit. So for years through my training, like all the way through my training, I just would have all these questions that no one could really answer. Like no one really pointed me to certain spaces. I remember having professors telling me like, you need to write that paper, or, I don't know, but what an interesting question. And it was, you know, I mean, it was lovely that they were open to kind of hearing those questions that they didn't pathologize. But it was also kind of disheartening as an up and coming person in the field to be like, nobody has answers, like, really? So I think over the years, it was a very painstaking process of gathering resources in terms of, I mean, first of all, just a bibliography of books and articles that were not a part of my training, because I had to read all different books and articles for my classes. But in parallel, I was building this bibliography that I was hearing from, you know, different sources or just mentioned offhand. And I was like, oh, I think that book is going to have maybe some of the answers, or that person may, but they're not here and I don't know how to get in touch with them. And that bibliography, by the way, evolved into this shared resource that's available via Color and Psychoanalysis of BIPOC scholars who have written about psychoanalysis and specifically from a perspective of addressing race, oppression, colonialism, et cetera, not just that the writers identify, you know, but they're actually tackling these topics, because that's something that I sought out during my training. And I'm hoping that other folks don't have to reinvent the wheel, that here's at least a starting point of, and I think at this point, because it's crowdsourced, I think there's some 90 resources of journals, articles, documentaries, you know, various resources that is about this. So I hope folks, even if you don't sign up, this is a resource that's available for anyone out there, however you identify, you know, to go use that and you know, build a curriculum around it, or do self-study, reading group, whatever it is. So that's one way that I found myself having to just kind of in my own time and, you know, noting bits and pieces of what's out there and then how can I sort of get my hands on it, that built into, I think, this collection of reading lists that I had. And then in addition, I think it was people and community and connections who I really want to put in a plug for AAPA, Asian American Psychological Association. I have a special love for this organization. I got introduced to it by my dissertation advisor, who I think in a really lovely and POC way kind of tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, you know, not just like check this out, but you can run for a position. You know, you can lead, you can like come into the community. And so that's how I ended up starting out as the student rep for Division on Practice. And I ended up staying on as an officer and moved through to becoming a chair of the division. But I think that space connected me to folks who, you know, it's funny because we don't necessarily wear our like psychoanalytic badge first and foremost, but many of us are. There are other training institutions, community-based training institutions here in the Bay Area, luckily that are fairly psychoanalytic and also really concerned with, you know, inclusivity and justice work. And so I really kind of had to pick and choose. And again, all of this was extracurricular, you know, getting involved in the association and putting in volunteer work, you know, taking the time to connect with mentors and peers and just saying, hey, you know, can we chat, or that all of it, I think, led to today. I feel so fortunate to have a community of mentors and peers and friends, really. I mean, these have become some of my closest friends who we talk about this stuff about. You know, I tell them about the project. We support each other. We show up to events together. You know, we have our like individual, you know, we'll kind of live text sometimes if it's a virtual event, and support each other in our work in this way so that we can show up in these spaces and show up as ourselves. My answer to this question, you know, the long and short of it is the dearth of resources and connections that are built in within a training experience. And since I've come out of grad school and you know, and I went to the Wright Institute, which I think does well in terms of promoting, you know, DEI efforts and social justice. And that's the reason why I chose this program. And us, of course, being situated in the Bay Area, like I think of myself as really fortunate actually to have a good amount of these resources, because since then I've heard from both professionals and students from other places in the country that if you're not in New York or LA or San Francisco Bay Area, it's even more difficult. It's harder. You could literally be the only person of color of any, you know, background of color. And so I just, every time I hear a story like that, I'm just, my heart goes out, you know, and I just want to be like, oh my gosh, you know, reach out, you know, if I can't do something, I can connect you with someone, because I think being alone in that way is just
overwhelming. Right. The isolation becomes more intense.
Yes.
In the experience. Yeah. It's quite amazing that, you know, in spite of this challenge that you faced, essentially it's like a curriculum, right? You know, you figure the curriculum will include these perspectives of people of color in psychodynamic, but instead you have to spend extra time outside to seek it out. And I think that is a problem. Absolutely. Especially when you're paying academic institutions for this so-called education, but you are doing it yourself. Well, Dr. Kadaba, thank you so much for your time today. How do we support you?
Check out coloringpsychoanalysis.com. Sign up, write for us, create art, and just reach out. You know, I love having these conversations. And I think, honestly, the part that I have enjoyed the most about starting this project, like I said, my selfish motivation for starting this is to meet other people who care about this, who want more of this. And so sign up, join up, let's talk, and let's keep building this together.
All right. Well, Dr. Kadaba, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you for the opportunity.
A huge thank you to our listeners. If you like what you've heard, please share and subscribe to our podcast, People of Color in Psychology. Other ways to support us include registering for continuing education courses or making a one-time donation on the Multicultural Counseling Institute's website. We value your input and appreciate your continued support. You can send us an email, a message on LinkedIn, or send a voice message on our website. Until next time, I am your host, Jack Sun.